This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is off today. Our week in review begins now with Boston's celebration of the country's independence, with fireworks on the Esplanade and in the wake of the marathon bombings, a big increase in security.
It's unfortunately necessary in these times.
Also this week, jurors in the trial of Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger hear his voice for the first time.
So I pick up a shotgun and I'm aiming it at them. The guy looks up.
See you later.
I put one in the chamber like...
And on Beacon Hill, a debate over how to fund the state's transportation needs and how much to tax.
This is a good piece of legislation. It's a real piece of legislation. It's going to get the job done.
But Governor Patrick disagrees.
It will never produce $800 million in new transportation funding.
And $1 trillion in student debt and going up. Washington lawmakers try but fail to prevent student loan interest rates from doubling.
This is about making sure that students can get an education without being indebted for the rest of their lives.
These are among the stories we'll dive into with our Week in Review panel. Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, joins us now. Hi, Callum. Good to see you.
Great to be back, Anthony.
And John Carroll, communications professor at BU and the man behind CampaignOutsider.com. Hi, John. Happy 4th, day after 4th.
Likewise, Anthony. Thanks.
So let's begin with yesterday's big 4th of July celebration and fireworks display on the Esplanade. Of course, the big story there was the heightened security in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings. Boston police, state troopers, National Guardsmen were out in force, along with new rules about what spectators could and couldn't bring in. Here's Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis on the Esplanade yesterday.
I think that there's a significant police presence here. We have uniformed officers, we have undercover officers, we have a lot of video surveillance. We're watching everything and making sure that we're intervening if we see something suspicious. So there's a lot of work going on.
Now, all of that, along with the very hot weather, made for a smaller crowd than usual. Police say some 300,000 folks showed up compared to a 500,000 in previous years. Callum, I'll start with you. You know, given what the city obviously went through last April, the stepped-up security is certainly understandable. But also a sad reminder of times we live in. What's your response to the way things were handled yesterday and the way the folks turned out?
Yeah, I guess two things struck me, Anthony. I mean, and they both relate to volume, right? You had the volume of the law enforcement presence there. I mean, and even to the extent that you had 55 new graduates from the police academy sworn in early just so that they could be on duty there. So you really saw that emphasis there. But also the volume of people and, you know, perhaps a smaller crowd than in previous years, but still a pretty darn good showing. And I thought that Keith Lockhart really struck a good tone when he mentioned, you know, this great showing by a crowd really shows people that we're going to refuse to live in fear and we're going to continue to congregate and celebrate.
Mm. John, what was your response to yesterday's
I'll add one more volume, which is the volume of press that was involved in covering the increased security, which probably is as big a factor or almost as big a factor as the security itself. It establishes an expectation on the part of people that who might want to disrupt the proceedings that it's going to be a lot harder and virtually impossible. So I think all of those things combined came together to produce what was a pretty uncontroversial increase in security. And I think that one of the issues that came up was the use of cameras, how extensive the use of security cameras would be, how long the images would be kept, what use they would be put to. This is all part of the debate that's been going on ever since the marathon bombing about the trade-off between safety and civil liberties. And I think that came up in a minor way yesterday, but it may be something that that comes up in a bigger way going forward.
Mm, well, certainly an indication of the times we live in. Well, let's move on to the racketeering and murder trial of Boston mob boss James Whitey Bulger. Over the past 4 weeks, we've heard testimony alleging Bulger's involvement in everything from money laundering to drug dealing to murder. This week, we heard, jurors heard, I should say, Bulger's voice for the first time in the trial. The prosecution played recordings of conversations that of Bulger's conversations while he was serving time in the Plymouth County Jail last year. So here he is back in December talking to his brother John about what he describes as an attempted robbery at his South Boston liquor store. Let's listen.
Three black guys come. They had a Rhode Island car. They're getting ready to stick the joint up.
Yeah.
So I pick up a shotgun and I'm aiming it at them. The guy looked up.
See you later.
I put one in the chamber like, and he looked up. One went this way, one went that way. When they first come in the store, they're looking around. They don't look up. And Stevie, he's got a 45 behind him, his back waiting for them to make a move. They were lucky they didn't try to do nothing.
So, Callum, I'm wondering what you think. I mean, we talked a little bit about this week, but what does this add to the case, being able, because there was no sort of smoking gun in any of these recordings, but it somehow added reality to what we're talking about, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure it really added anything, other than reminding us just how insensitive, perhaps, Whitey Bulger could be, in addition to talking about that sort of botched stick-up. And by the way, that goes on the list of, worst criminals ever, right? Of all the liquor stores to pick, Whitey Bulger's, But otherwise, though, talking about, this sort of gunning a guy down with a machine gun, in a phone booth, and just sort of the cavalier manner in which he discusses that, doesn't outright confess to doing it. So that's why I say I don't know that it really adds much, in terms of evidence to the case. But it certainly does, continue this depiction of him as this insensitive person who was, very comfortable with gunplay. People getting gunned down on the street was a common occurrence in his world, at least. And I think that's really what it adds is some color.
Yeah, there's almost, John, he talks about this stuff in sort of this breezy, easy way almost.
Yeah, there's a couple of other things about that. First of all, the daughter of Edward Connors, who had been shot down in the phone booth, she came on and talked about the last time she saw him he left that day. She was 7 years old. That adds a real human dimension to it. The other part of it that struck me was Bulger was having that conversation about that murder with his niece and nephew. And it's one thing for him to talk that way with gangsters, other gangsters. When you start talking that way with civilians, I think it casts him in a different light. And it certainly cast William Bulger's son and daughter in a different light, the description of it anyway in the newspapers, or them laughing along with Whitey Bulger about this. I think that was something that made that particular tape stand out, the context of it and also the audience for it.
We also heard testimony from a former drug dealer, William Shea, who spoke of Bulger's role in the drug trade in the 70s and the 80s. And for the longest time, Bulger denied that he pushed drugs in Southie, which I guess was one of those denials that everyone heard. But as time went on, few people believed. But Callum, were you struck by any of that, just about how big, how involved this drug business was and how lucrative it was as well?
Yeah, the thing that stood out to me about Shea's testimony was the fear that even he had of Bulger. And I think that part of the defense's tactic here, right, has been to sort of shift the focus off of Bulger and say, yes, he committed certain crimes, but really the focus is on other people's shortcomings. Look at the corrupt law enforcement and that sort of thing. But this was a reminder from another guy who was, up to his neck in criminal activity, by his own account, taking in $100,000 a week, in cocaine sales. And this guy was terrified of Bulger himself. And I think that really speaks to the dominant, sort of alpha dog role that he played in Boston's criminal underworld.
Yeah, the lucrative part, even Bulger didn't know how lucrative it was, apparently, because
he was only getting $10,000 a week.
Right, and Billy Shea is saying, I'm making $100,000 a week, and then all of a sudden he goes, oops, and looks at Whitey and thinks, oh, well, I shouldn't have probably said that. So I think that he didn't know. But if we ever needed any evidence, I mean, the worst-kept secret in Boston was that Whitey Bulger was dealing drugs in South Boston. He didn't drive the drug dealers out. He didn't keep South Boston kids safe from drugs. He was peddling them by proxy. So if we ever needed proof of that, we have it now, but I don't think anybody ever really believed that.
Well, lots more to come, obviously, in the weeks and months ahead on that story. Let's move on to the argument on Beacon Hill over transportation funding and taxes. The legislature has approved a 3 cent per gallon hike in the state's gas tax. Governor Patrick says that's not enough to close a massive transportation funding gap, so he'd like to raise the gas tax by up to 8 cents a gallon. Here's his transportation secretary, Richard Davey, speaking to us earlier this week.
You can't buy a dollar a cup of coffee with 50 cents, and that's what we have here. The transportation bill we said we would sign is $805 million. It will only be $670 million under today's law.
So Davey says the House and Senate budget, the package approved by the House and Senate, won't provide enough money to maintain that transportation system in Massachusetts. Not so, say, key Beacon Hill legislators. Here's Senator Stephen Brewer, chair of the Ways and Means Committee, telling us that the House-Senate plan balances investments in transportation while being mindful of taxpayer dollars.
We are prudent stewards of the taxpayers' money. We understand in a recovering economy that the extent and depth that we would reach into the taxpayer's pocket is something that is something we take very, very seriously. But we make the meaningful investments to put and position Massachusetts on a positive foot for going forward in the future.
Now, Callum, this argument quickly sort of gets into the weeds about an argument about tolls in Western Massachusetts and when they're going to be shut down. But, you know, straighten this out for us. What's the issue here? What are we really arguing about?
Well, big picture, I think what I find disheartening is that this $800 million figure was supposed to be sort of a compromise, right? I mean, because the governor ideally wants $1.2 billion in additional funding for transportation. He's saying, look, I realize that may be unrealistic. I'm willing to settle for $800 million a year, but I don't even think that the bill that you've put forward is even going to achieve that. And I think that's really what the issue is here, is that you have this potential compromise figure, and he doesn't think they can hit the target.
So they're not even compromising. So, John, where do you see this going? How's this debate going to play out?
There's a lot of political kabuki going on here. And I think that that what's going to happen is, first of all, the only reason we're even seeing this bill is that it's not an election year. So so I think that if this were an election year, this bill wouldn't be, even be this far along. But I think what's going to happen is there's going to be some kind of split the difference kind of approach to this and compromise. And they'll get to it eventually. There's a lot of money at stake here. And I think that Deval Patrick has big dreams, and this is all about his legacy pretty much, big dreams for how he can leave the state when his term is up. And I think that this is a big part of it, and I think he's going to play pretty tough. On the other hand, it looks like the bill is veto-proof, so I think the legislature can probably override him if he does veto the bill.
Well, let's move on to another legislative standoff, this one in Washington, and it reminds us of two things, the rising cost of a college education and the legislative paralysis that exists in Washington. Everyone from both sides of the aisle said they wanted to fix this problem, but the Republicans and Democrats couldn't come to an agreement. The result, interest rates on federal student loans doubled the start of this past week from 3.2% to 6.8%. And this is significant because Americans already owe $1 trillion in outstanding student loans. This is only going to add to that debt burden going down the road. Both sides more or less agree that the rates should be pegged to prevailing interest rates, but Democrats want to cap that rate. Republicans are worried about the long-term cost. Callum, what do you see as the effect on all of this and how it's going to play out?
Well, I guess the ray of hope here is that it's not totally over yet. The rates have effectively doubled, but we're still in the summer, of course, and the term for most students doesn't begin until the fall. So there's a little bit of wiggle room and some hope that perhaps they could come to a compromise before the fall term begins. But again, I think this is a case where, you know, you just have to scratch your head, right? Because both sides essentially want the same thing. They agree that the rate should stay at 3.4%.
It seems like they're both so stuck and not wanting to let the other side have credit that they're willing to sort of, I don't know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Is that the right metaphor? But you know what I mean.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think that in each case, you're sort of trying to tie the interest rate to something else, right? Because in each case, that's why it's been shot down from one side or the other, right? And they're saying, you know, the Republicans will say, well, you know, we agree that it should be 3.4%, but you're also attaching such and such, and the Republicans are, you know, being accused of the same thing by the Democrats, and I think that's really the frustrating part here.
Yeah, so the average student graduates, this is the national figure, with about $27,000 of debt. It's higher here in Massachusetts. This increase would add about $2,600 over a 10-year loan. So it's not a huge increase. Still, it sort of pushes that debt load in the wrong direction. John, what do you see as the solution? Callum suggests that, you know, this game isn't over. There's time to get it done still. Do you think that's going to finally happen?
Yeah, I think a lot of politicians home on their Independence Day recess are getting an earful from students and from parents, and I think they may come back with a little more motivation to actually sort this out. I mean, this only applies to one quarter of federal student loans, and it only applies to loans going forward. So in a way, the uproar is a little disproportionate. Yeah. On the other hand, it's symbolic, and it's one of those sort of touchstone issues that that says a lot about the state of dysfunction down in Washington, D.C. And I think that you've got a vocal and a very literate group in college students who could probably make themselves heard on this one.
One of the points that came up in our discussion this week is that this debate about interest rates is really a a distraction from the real problem, and that is that the cost of college keeps going up and up and up and up. What do you think, Kendall?
Well, I think you make a good point, because that extra $2,600, it's sort of, you know, 5 pounds on an elephant, right? I mean, it's you know, you're already coming out with so much debt. And that, I think, $27,000 figure you quoted, I mean, certainly there are plenty of folks who are well above that, to say nothing of graduate school or you know, medical school or law school. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really, you know, one of the great issues of our time right now, is that cost of education and whether or not folks can affordably advance themselves and lift themselves up from whatever sort of economic scale that they grew up in, and whether they can afford to really better themselves. I mean, that is essentially, we're talking about the foundation of the American dream.
Can I just make a quick disclosure here? As a college professor, I just want to say that absolutely none of that money is going to come to me. So just in case there's any concern about my vested interest in this conversation,
I
have no financial interest here.
All right, good. Because I was going to ask if you should be recused from this part of the conversation, but I'm glad that you sort of cleared that up for us, John.
Thank you.
All right, with that, I think we've got just enough time to go into our hubbubs, those stories that didn't quite rise above the fold this weekend. And let me come to you, Callum, for your hubbub.
Well, the Massachusetts Challenge is underway now, and if you're not familiar with the program, it's an accelerator for young companies, and they come from all over the world. This year's finalists are 128 startup companies. They represent 12 different countries, and they're all sort of clustered on the 14th floor of this building in South Boston, sharing this very industrial-looking office space. High stakes for these folks. Mm. You know, there's more than $1 million in prize money at stake. They'll spend about 4 months working together, and really they're all trying to solve a wide variety of problems. I've been hanging out with some of them in the last week or so, and you've got everything from an application that will diagnose what's wrong with your car to, you know, an app that will make a 3D avatar of yourself to go online shopping. Mm. But one thing that just made me giggle this week was, you know, this is an example of the creativity of these folks. I'm washing up in the men's room and notice on the counter this section full of you know, Imodium and antihistamines and flossers, and it's labeled the Entrepreneur's Emergency Kit. And if you think about it, these are they're all looking for money, right? And they're meeting VCs, and the worst thing that could happen, right, is you're going into that meeting with a piece of spinach stuck in your teeth. So some really smart person put together this emergency kit, and they're going to be all set no matter what happens.
Fantastic. John, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub is, twice in the past week or so, tribute ads have run in the Boston Globe, but not in the Boston Herald. So it started out with a memorial ad for Boston firefighter Stephen F. Minahan, who died 19 years ago in a Charlestown warehouse blaze. On that spot right now, on Tudor Wharf, there's a Marriott Hotel. They ran an ad, a memorial ad, remembering Lieutenant Minahan, and also saluting for all first responders. It was really very nice. Mm-hmm. The odd thing was, we're in a two-daily town. You look and you see, does it run in the Boston Herald? It does not. Not only that, it ran twice in the same edition of the Boston Globe. And they're not even sure how that happened. They said, well, we have to wait for the bill to see how that happened. A couple of days later, the Chicago Blackhawks take out a full-page ad in the Boston Globe saluting the Bruins and the city of Boston. Also, again, no ad in the Boston Herald. Now, you have to wonder that there are hockey fans who read the Boston Herald. There are people who are concerned about first responders who read the Boston Herald. Why doesn't the Boston Herald get these ads? And all I can think of is the classic story of the publisher of the New York Post who ran into the president of Bloomingdale's, Marvin Traub, and said to him, how come the Bloomingdale's doesn't advertise in the Post? And the Bloomingdale's president looked at him and said, because your readers are my shoplifters. that, I think, is the prevailing attitude about the Boston Herald, and I think it's wrong.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It's very brief. Actually, Callum, the Globe did a nice little feature on this week, as did we, and that is the much loved bakery in Boston's North End, Boschetto's, is shutting down after 118 years in business. So a city moves on, says goodbye to Boschetto's Bakery. The reason? High rents, rising rents, in this case, the tripling of a rent, and they just couldn't make a go of it. And listeners, there is a short feature at RadioBoston.org about the closing of Boschetto's Bakery after 118 years in business. Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, and John Carroll, communications professor at BU, who runs the blog campaigneroutsider.com. Thank you both, gentlemen. Have a great weekend. Thanks for coming in.
You too. Thanks.
Always fun. Thanks for having us.
Listeners, stay with us. Up next, walkable Boston and why the city's future depends on how far you can get with your own 2 feet. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.